embroidered by the artistic hands of their mothers. Hand embroidery on colorful clothes and fabric is among the most important crafts of Baluchi women. And fortunately, Baluchi women have been able to preserve this exquisite art, a skill handed down through generations. It's noontime. It can get really hot in Shirguaz, even in the middle of winter. But the boys of the village have a good solution to fighting the scorching heat. What they do at a time like this is jump into the waters of Shirguaz River and swim to their heart's content. These children usually play together in groups. The day offers an opportunity for me to make a return to the beautiful carefree days of my own childhood. Live life as an uninhibited, unabashed explorer of the unknown. Playing with these children serves as an outlet for the negative energy in me. Although the children in Shirguaz don't have much to entertain themselves with, they're all growing up happy, healthy, and strong by playing in groups and making the best of what their natural environment provides them with. No computers to spend the whole day on, playing virtual computer games that don't involve any physical activity, video games that have taken the place of playing outside for many kids today, outdoor experiences in nature, and plenty of physical activity that a growing body craves. These children's only toy is nature, going up trees, diving into the river and swimming, playing with animals, singing songs and helping their parents at home and on the farm, frolicking around and playing with stones and pebbles. This non-stop joyful mobility is the reason behind these children's physical health and happy disposition. Very soon, I leave the village and set out for my next destination. I have to travel 250 kilometers to the west of Baluchistan, to a place 80 kilometers north of the city of Nikshar, a name that reminds me of my country's beautiful north. Given its unique geographical location, Baluchistan has a diverse and strange climate. Some parts of this area is affected by the tropical climate of India, in the south by the Sea of Oman, in the west by the Jazmurian inland basin, and in the north by Lut Desert. Surrounded by these different climatic conditions, Baluchistan features diverse lifestyles and various plant and animal species. Baluchistan is a dry, water-thirsty land. The average annual rainfall in the province is around 110 millimeters. But the important thing is, all that water comes down in only a couple of torrential rainfalls that cause the rivers in the province to overflow their banks. The ensuing flooding leaves behind a trail of destruction every time. The people here tell me they get snow and blizzards in some winters too, because of the mountains in the Gorgan area. Perhaps you'll find it interesting to know there is a place named Gorgan in Sistan and Balochistan province. But no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Gorgan in the north of Iran. This area is comprised of around 11 villages punctuating this mountainous area. It can get freezing cold here. The people of Balochistan say, except for Mount Taftan and Mount Basman, the only other place where you can see snow in the highlands is the same Gorgan region in Balochistan. It can get really cold here. Because of the altitude and the relatively good rainfall here, this valley usually has a good amount of water, and abundant water means life and prosperity. The people of Gorgan are either farmers or orchard owners or livestock keepers. The most important thing for them to be able to do any of those things is to have clean drinking water. The people of the first village I visit are very kind and hospitable. In my conversations with them, I realize all the young people in the village are busy working simply because there is enough water. Everyone has something to do. They're all grateful to God for all their blessings. Their biggest asset is contentment. I could say most of the things I've seen in this village were built from scratch by the men and women living here. They are all content with what they have. They even have electricity. They live a beautiful, simple, and healthy life, away from the hustle and bustle of city life and excesses that distract human beings from their true self and from nature. The Baluch community leads a simple lifestyle in their simple homes in Balochistan. They don't even expect a paved road. The peace that these lovely people exude is a breath of fresh air against the vicissitudes of city life. I am so at peace when I'm in their fold. Before long, I resume my journey and arrive in the village of Archenik, a bucolic settlement second to none. But it isn't the architecture and natural environment that lends Archenik its beauty. The most beautiful thing I come across is the hospitality of the local inhabitants. Archenikis are hard-working, hospitable people. Moments after I reach the village, one of the elders comes to welcome me and invite me to his beautiful house. And the family gives me the red carpet treatment. Personally, I have a lot of respect for the culture and customs of this lovely ancient tribe and have tried my best not to have a negative impact on the culture or any of the good social norms of this community. Instead, I learned from them things that I had no idea about before I met them. I have had many trips to far and exotic places in Iran. And on those trips, I saw many and varied village houses and nomad tents. But nothing like the teeps in the Gorgan region. Beautiful, modest homes that offer peace and tranquility, just like their natural surroundings. Village elder, Pir Muhammad, fills me in on how they build their houses. My trip is nearing its end. That means I have to leave the beautiful Sistan and Balochistan province and head back home. I leave with a bag of experience and memories as sweet as the dates of Gorgan. And I do so knowing that I haven't done any harm to the natural environment and the culture of this ancient tribe.
Well, I'm quite sure that this week's documentary about Iran's natural wonders intrigued all our audience across the globe. And I hope it inspires you to come and explore the hidden treasures of Iran. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us. And until next week, goodbye.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
There is no denying of the fact that the organized killers of peaceful Muslims are not Muslims, and there are no second thoughts on meting out justice to such godless elements who have no faith in any religion or school of thought, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Godless Elements Creating Sedition in Pakistan. Stay tuned for more. We are in the blessed month of Shaban, when the gates of paradise are flung open to the believers who adhere to the dynamic teachings of the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the humanitarian values expounded by his immaculate Ahlul Bayt. While the flames of hell leap to drag into the fiery bowels of the enemies of humanity, including the godless hypocrites who pose as Muslims to wantonly shed innocent Muslim blood. In a famous hadith recorded by both Sunni and Shia Muslims, the Prophet of Peace said, "When the first day of Sha'ban arrives, Satan spreads out his troops throughout the corners of the earth and its horizons, telling them to try to attract some of God's servants toward themselves. Indeed, God Almighty and Glorious also scatters his angels throughout the earth's quarters and horizons, telling them, 'Guide my servants and show them the right way,' whereat all of them will attain felicity through you, except such of them who refuse and are arrogant and rebellious. These join the party of Satan and enter his host." On March 4th, in the city of Peshawar in Pakistan, the hordes of Satan raised their ugly head to trigger bomb blasts at a mosque during the weekly Friday prayer, martyring scores of worshippers. The deadly terrorist attack also ended the miserable life of some of these godless perpetrators who might have been blown through remote control. If we discount the reports that they staged a suicidal attack by assaulting two police guards to enter the mosque and detonate explosive belts. Either way, these devils in human form, who are the avowed enemies of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his immaculate, and masquerade as Muslims to kill and cause sedition amongst Muslims, chose to plunge into the eternal inferno. while the worshippers who lost their life in prayer in the Kucheri Saladhar Mosque are definitely enjoying the bliss of paradise, leaving behind in the world grieving parents, widows, and orphans. As we go to the press, over 70 innocent souls have so far lost their life and over 200 others injured. But the questions persist. Why proper security measures are not taken by authorities? And why does the government of Pakistan hesitate from arresting and exterminating these un-Islamic outfits who, as is crystal clear, despite their use Muslim names, have no connection to Islam? Iran's foreign ministry spokesman urged the Pakistani government and security officials to adopt necessary strategies and take serious measures to prevent criminal activities of terrorists. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Peshawar terrorist attack was aimed at creating sectarian divisions and is definitely against the unity of the Ummah. It is obvious from videos and photos circulating online with ambulances rushing through congested narrow streets and ferrying the wounded to hospitals and the senior officials right from the president and the prime minister of the country offering condolences to the bereaved family members that the authorities are sparing no efforts in their duties to the victimized citizens. Yet the question arises, what is the solution to these recurring bouts of terrorism? Why Pakistan's blasphemy laws are not applied to these terrorist outfits on the payroll of the CIA and the Zionist splinter Muslim ranks? There is no denying of the fact that the organized killers of peaceful Muslims are not Muslims, and there are no second thoughts on meting out justice to such godless elements who have no faith in any religion or school of thought. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as part of its friendly and fraternal policy towards Pakistan, is willing to cooperate in efforts to track down these criminal hordes of Satan in order to protect Muslims from harm, sedition, and disunity. Let us recall another passage from the famous hadith of the Prophet of Islam on doing good and abstaining from evil that was mentioned before. On the advent of the first of Sha'ban, God Almighty and Glorious commands the gates of paradise to open, and He commands the tree of Tuba, whereat it spreads its branches all over the world. Thereat, a herald of our Lord, Almighty and Glorious, calls out, O servants of God, these are the branches of the tree of Tuba. So catch hold of them so that they may lift you up toward paradise. And those are the branches of the tree of Zakum. Beware of them. Let them not draw you toward hell. The Prophet of Allah said, By him who sent me as a prophet with the truth, whoever approaches one of the doors of goodness and piety on this day adheres to a branch of the tree of Tuba, and is taken toward paradise. And whoever approaches one of the doors of evil on this day is stuck to a branch of the Zakum tree, which draws him toward hell.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax. But still, the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alcock, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong, but Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem that is largely blamed on Donald Trump. Tehran now says the sanctions must be removed in a verifiable manner, and Washington must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the agreement again. The United States has been dragging its feet so far, but Tehran says it will not back down from its red lines.
Iran can't go through the same thing again. I mean, in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally, abrogated the JCPOA, slapped on punitive sanctions. Iran had had 3.5 years of intense economic suffering, and it doesn't want to see that happen again. It doesn't want to sign some treaty. Only to see, to see the same thing happen either in, either later this year or in 2024 when, if Donald Trump is reelected.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani has warned that if the Vienna talks do not lead to a good deal, the current U.S. administration will feel defeated in the near future due to lack of timely use of diplomatic opportunities. As all eyes are on the venue of the talks in Vienna, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, will visit Tehran on Saturday to hold talks with Iran's nuclear chief and other top officials. The IAEA says the two sides will discuss outstanding safeguards issues with a view to addressing them. Does Grossi's trip boost the chances of a deal in Vienna? It is hard to guess at this point. The negotiations have been very complex, and there is no guarantee that they will end in a deal. It now seems that the fate of the diplomatic effort largely depends on whether the West will finally choose to make necessary political decisions.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has blamed the American regime for the current Ukraine crisis. He demanded an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic of Iran has always opposed war and destruction anywhere in the world. The U.S. disrupted the stability of the country by interfering in its affairs and organizing rallies and creating a color coup. We oppose the killing of people and the destruction of the infrastructure of nations. Leader called the U.S. a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance, saying it feeds off the crises it creates all around the world.
Washington are glorified mobsters. That's all. America does to all of its allies. You've got to remember, there's a very good saying, if you're an American enemy, they might bribe you and bring you into their team. If you're their ally, good luck to you, sir.
Ayatollah Khamenei is referring to years of U.S. meddling in Ukraine since it became an independent state in 1990s. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. pledged not to expand NATO eastward, close to the borders with Russia. But the U.S. and its Western allies reneged their pledges and started to include more Eastern European countries into the Western military alliance. In 2014, the U.S. implemented a color revolution in Ukraine and overthrew its democratically elected government. U.S. also supported the inclusion of right-wing groups and elements within Ukraine's government. It's now widely believed that in trying to move Ukraine into their orbit, Washington and its European allies overextended themselves, and Russia's intervention, firstly in facilitating Crimea's reunification with Moscow in 2014, then with the official recognition of the independence and sovereignty of the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, and now with a wider military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, is the result. Elsewhere, in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said there are lessons to be drawn with regard to the Ukraine crisis. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is only, quote, a mirage. Iran's leader said both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani have acknowledged that the U.S. simply abandoned them amid their domestic crises. As the crisis unfolded in Ukraine, the country's president, Zelensky, rued being left alone by the West. The U.S. has refused to send in soldiers to the country to protect its people and has only pledged more money and weapons.
Well, the Ukrainian president was basically helped into power by American advisors and American campaign organizers. The Ukrainian president was told that he could go ahead and put down by force the Donbass ethnic Russians who revolted after the government in Ukraine banned their language and restricted their ethnic autonomy.
The same scenario happened in Afghanistan, when after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. disastrously pulled out of the country, leaving President Ghani and Afghan people alone in the face of Taliban fighters. The U.S. is facing backlash over its treatment of its Arab allies. Despite selling them weapons worth billions of dollars and pledging support, it has failed to provide them with sustainable security.
More desperate. They put you in a more serious situation than you were before, and the terms that they dictate to you are much, much more demanding than it would have been had you not taken the actions that they allowed you to take at the first. So Zelensky took actions against his own ethnic Russian citizens at the bidding of the United States, at their will.
It's now become apparent that the failure of successive U.S. presidents and their European allies since the end of the Soviet era has been to overestimate their own power and underestimate that of Russia, China, Iran, and other countries that are outside their sphere of influence.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. Bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea. Bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now. And they have to know this is, it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat, we had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal. Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbas. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbas.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the U.S., have taken. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then, if it wasn't willing to face the music?
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
They learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue, since the Trump administration, continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea or South Korea is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea all forces.
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sarah Kleiner Ryder. This article is published under the heading Rural America is facing an invisible eviction crisis. Stay tuned for more. About 70 miles northwest of the U.S. capital, in the affluent Virginia countryside and across the state line into West Virginia, there is a house on a hill in a deteriorating neighborhood. Inside sits Melody Schaffer, rubbing her red-rimmed eyes at the dining table. Her husband, Chris Pasco, paces between the dimly lit kitchen and living room. Paint peels from a nearby door frame. Schaffer repeatedly says when asked where they would go now that they were about to be evicted. I have no clue. It was the day before Thanksgiving. At the bustling Walmart down the road, shoppers filled their carts with potatoes, stuffing, green beans, and pumpkin pie, oblivious to the scene that had unfolded that morning in Country Courthouse. Jefferson County Magistrate Judge Vicky Dangelo had ruled in favor of three landlords and ordered the tenants living in their homes, including Schaffer and Pasco, to vacate by December 3rd. To wait and do this in the winter time, right before it gets cold, Schaffer trailed off. Statistically speaking, not much is known about evictions that are occurring outside the U.S. urban areas during the COVID-19 pandemic. There is no national system that monitors eviction cases in real time. The largest set of publicly available data is gathered by Princeton Eviction Lab, which is tracking cases in 6 states and 31 cities. Data in those urban areas show mixed trends. In places with few tenant protections, the number of cases is growing up, according to Eviction Lab. But tenants' lawyers in the country's less populated regions say they are also handling more cases now that the federal moratorium on evictions has expired. States like West Virginia, South Dakota, Delaware, and Arkansas have been slow to dole out rental assistance from the federal government, money that's meant to be a levy holding back a flood of evictions. Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Other pots of money have been slow to be spent too, including $9 billion the Department of Housing and Urban Development sent to states and cities to combat housing-related COVID-19 fallout. Brent Thompson, Executive Director for East River Legal Services, which provides representation to low-income residents in eastern South Dakota, said, "My frustration is widespread. It's just sad when you see a continuing problem day in and day out, and there is only so much you can do for them. Thompson said the biggest hurdle he has faced in South Dakota is lack of information for tenants, many of whom were living in poverty before COVID-19 swept through the state. Thompson said, "We have developed a culture where people don't tend to avail themselves for protections afforded to them. This isn't a new problem. It's a problem that's being magnified by the pandemic and reaching a crisis point because of the pandemic." Back when the federal eviction moratorium was in place, people living in South Dakota tended to simply move elsewhere when their landlords threatened to evict, rather than fight for their right to stay, Thompson said. And many tenants either don't know about the state's $200 million rental assistance allocation from the federal government or haven't been able to access those funds. As of October 31st, only 4% of that money had been distributed to tenants and landlords, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. A November report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition placed South Dakota and Wyoming last among states for the share of rental assistance they had sent to tenants and landlords. The South Dakota Housing Development Authority, which is administering the state's rental assistance programs, has distributed aid to more than 5,200 households with money from the federal government, said Amanda Weiss-Graham, spokesperson for the agency. The state approved 75% of the completed applications it received. Weiss-Graham noted the need for assistance isn't as acute in South Dakota because the state's businesses weren't forced to close during the pandemic, and residents weren't required to stay home. But Thompson's office saw a 30% jump in eviction cases for 4 months in a row earlier this year, and he said the need for attorneys is growing. Only 8 attorneys cover this 33-county region, which spans 30,000 square miles. His territory is home to a large population of undocumented migrant workers and indigenous people, groups that have historically been exploited by landlords. South Dakota ranks last in terms of access to legal representation, according to the National Center for Access to Justice. In Delaware, landlords have been hesitant to sign up for rental assistance programs, said Dan Atkins, executive director of Community Legal Aid Society Incorporation. Landlords have balked at providing financial records to the state government, and they haven't wanted to give up the right to evict tenants in exchange for receiving rental payments. "You can't drag a horse to water, but you can't make them drink," Atkins said. "We will drag them to the water, but we don't know if they will drink." Many of the lowest income tenants in Delaware don't know about the rental assistance available to them. "They don't have reliable access to internet, and some people aren't able to read," Atkins said. "All of this is a challenge when the state requires pages of documentation proving financial hardship. Plus, there is a narrative in the low-income community that no one is going to help," he said. Over 80% of landlords are represented in eviction cases in Delaware, Atkins said, while fewer than 5% of tenants have lawyers by their side. "There is not enough legal aid to go around," Atkins said. "We are starting to see the floodgates open a bit, and we are looking over our shoulder and wondering if it's going to be a big tidal wave soon." As of October 31st, only 10% of Delaware's $200 million allocation in rental assistance had been doled out to tenants and landlords, according to data from the Treasury Department. In Arkansas, state officials were lagging behind most other states for the first 7 months of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, but they picked up the pace of distributing money in October, Treasury Department data show. Still, that's only used up 22% of the state's $174 million allocation. The public badly needs access to rental assistance funds, said Kendall Levington, housing subject area manager for the Center for Arkansas Legal Services, adding that the state amended its policies to make it easier for tenants to access the aid. He said, "I just hope that it isn't too late for most people." As of October 15th, Levin's office had handled twice as many landlord-tenants cases in 2021 as it did in the same period in 2020. Eviction in Arkansas is uniquely punitive, Levin said. It's the only state in the U.S. that charges tenants with a crime for failing to pay their rent and vacate their home. Nearly 450 people were charged with that misdemeanor crime between March 2020 and November 2021 in Arkansas, according to data from the state's court system. Of those, 133 were found guilty. Back in West Virginia, Schaffer and Pasco went living in a neighborhood littered with rotting tires and stacks of lumber. The house next door was shrouded by dead vines. As of December 15, they hadn't found a place they could afford to rent, and they were thinking they had have to spend the night outside. They didn't apply for rental assistance because the process would take weeks to complete, and Pasco's income as a handyman in the flooring business had dried up. So had the income of Johnny Harrell, who was in the tree trimming business in nearby Charlestown. Harrell said his employer died and he was suddenly out of work. He said he had never missed a rental payment before, but he could no longer afford to pay $500 a month. His landlord, Alex Salgado, purchased a small building Harrell was living in about 18 months ago. Harrell was the first person he had to evict. Salgado said, "It's a circle, right? I need to get money in so I can pay for the building." Like Schaffer and Pasco, Harrell found out the day before Thanksgiving that he would be evicted by December 3rd. He didn't want to move into his son's home, which was already crowded. The only place he could think to live was inside an old pop-up camper on a nearby campground. It isn't insulated, and the temperatures were already dropping below freezing at night. At the last minute, Harold's relatives helped him rent an apartment in Maryland so he wouldn't have to sleep in the camper. "It felt loosey," Harold said of his experience in the courtroom. "You work all your life and you're fine, and you keep going no matter what happens. And you know what? It was heartbreaking."